Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyau from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-pro anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
And I'm Karen Greenberg.
And this is Spy Talk. Welcome back to another edition of our weekly podcast. Our guest today is Scott Anderson, author of King of Kings, The Iranian Revolution, A Story of Hubris, Delusion, and Catastrophic Miscalculation, a book that's been getting rave reviews across the spectrum from everybody. And it's a very interesting talk. And he will tell you, and we will remind you, why it's so important and what happened a half century ago in Iran, how it's animating U.S.-Iranian relations today. But first, we've got some things that are on our mind for the week. And what's on my mind this week is, again, Laura Loomer, who you might characterize last month as the Rasputin of the Trump presidency. I mean, I may have
underplayed her significance, actually.
Maybe. I mean, this week, she apparently intervened to keep the co-chair or the ranking Democrat of the Senate Intelligence Committee from dropping in on one of the intelligence agencies. And his job is to oversee U.S. intelligence agencies. And apparently, Laura Loomer somehow got in the middle of that and Pete Hegseth stepped in and denied him entrance to the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. So, I mean, what are we to make of this?
I mean, it really is just so extraordinary that this, like, you know, wacky woman from Florida with no apparent qualifications, expertise, government service, anything, is sort of become the MAGA enforcer for the entire U.S. government, and can just, like, you know, put, you know, rail on X against somebody, and in Washington they all jump.
Really, Karen, you know, you are a kind of a specialist, you might say, in women in national security. This is a subject of yours for a long time now. Where would you place Laura Loomer in terms of women in national security?
Well, that, you know, the question is, she's not a woman in national security, right? When I say women in national security, I think
she's overseeing national
security. Exactly. And that's the problem. I mean, you know, this idea of just having, you know, people that can just randomly or be invited in without any kind of vetting, any kind of official role, really just makes the whole apparatus look kind of fraudulent, because how is everybody there if the hierarchy no longer works the way it does, if the processes for deciding who gets what information, when they get it, doesn't exist? It could just be interfered with no official standing.
Okay, well, the phrase "it leaves me speechless" comes to mind. Mm-hmm. I don't know what else we can say about it. Let's move along. I mean, yeah, that's a nutcase overseeing U.S. intelligence in many ways. So, Mike, what's on your mind this week?
Well, a pretty fascinating and significant ruling from a federal judge in New York that got very little attention, but
until we brought it up,
and it's something that's going to be getting a lot of attention, and that is, for more than 20 years, the families of 9/11 victims have been suing the Saudi government, accusing it of complicity in the 9/11 attacks. And they didn't get very far for many, many years. The Saudis have great lawyers. Congress had to intervene to allow the lawsuit to proceed. There was limited discovery, and it all focused on claims. Much of it focused on claims that there were a number of Saudis, two in particular, who were providing substantial support for two of the hijackers on 9/11 who first flew into the country in January 2000. This is Khalid al-Madar and Nawaf al-Hazmi. Much has been written about them. In this ruling by the judge, because the Saudis had moved to dismiss the case, saying that the help that these two people, Omar al-Bayoumi, a Saudi student, and Fahad al-Fuderi, who was the imam in Los Angeles, had provided all this help to the hijackers. They claimed, and the Saudis claimed, this was all purely innocent. They had no idea who these people were. They were just trying to help fellow Muslims adjust to a new country. The judge went through the evidence, finally, including hundreds of pages of internal FBI documents, and said, no, there's a case here. He gave a green light for the families to proceed. He pointed to phone records showing that these two people, Bayoumi in particular, were in repeated contact with officials at the Saudi embassy at precisely the time that he was providing this aid to the hijackers. And the judge ultimately said, it is, given those phone calls, the Saudi argument is unpersuasive, given the frequency and timing of the calls, and in particular, how the calls between the relevant individuals seem to follow one after another during a short relevant time period. This doesn't prove the case, but it allows the families to go forward and get further discovery about internal FBI and CIA documents that have never been released about 9/11.
Yes, and it makes us think about two other things. What about the 9/11 Commission report? Where all this evidence they went through, all of this material they've had access to that we haven't had access to, where is this narrative? Why did it come out differently in the 9/11?
So that's the first. And why was it a lot of this FBI evidence was buried for years, just discovered, almost thrown away?
All of this, you know, just makes you wonder, where did that go, that narrative, and how did that happen? But the second thing is Guantanamo, right? We have a 9/11 trial of the alleged co-conspirators of 9/11 that has never happened. It has not started. Do you know what would, and the reason is largely the issues over evidence that have to do with torture and how it can't be presented in a courtroom, et cetera, all this stuff about state secrets, et cetera. But the point is that if you did have a trial, some of this would have come out. It's possible that some of this would have come out.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in terms of what connections and who was pulling the strings and what was happening. So it really makes you wonder, you know, in whose favor is it to have delayed the 9/11 trial to the point where it's been delayed? So,
yeah, dredging up that whole quote about, you know, it's not history. It's not even over. 9/11 is going on and on and on. It's still with us.
Just a couple of quick thoughts. The 9/11 Commission report took a big hit with the ruling by Judge Daniels in New York, because the 9/11 Commission in their report had dismissed the idea that there was any Saudi role, had dismissed the questions about Bayoumi and Fumeri, but it did not have access to the evidence that was presented in court from the FBI, which has only become available in the last couple of years.
I'm inclined to bring on the author or authors of the 9/11 Commission report, bring them on our podcast and ask them about this.
Yeah, let's see what they have to say. Right.
So, Karen, what's on your mind this week?
You know, I'm a little bit focused on this speedboat that was attacked by, we're not even sure what, with a Reaper or some other kind of aerial bombardment that killed the 11 people aboard it that it was allegedly carrying drugs. We don't really know what kind of drugs or how many. No. A Venezuelan boat. And what this actually means in outside of the incident itself, in terms of one, presidential powers. Is this an act of war that he should have gone to Congress for? Two, how we define our relationship with Venezuela and other countries where we're talking about drug dealing and drug supplies and things like that. Three, this is an absolute change in protocol and lawfulness when it comes to how you apprehend suspected drug traffickers at sea. You have the Coast Guard board them in prior times, right? But it's also what was really going on. If you look at what Marco Rubio has been saying in the recent past, you know, this attack on Maduro, and, you know, thinking that he is part of Trenta Aragua and involved in that, and all of these allegations, what's the purpose of this? Is it a distraction, or is it something that could escalate? And I, you know, we have more and more ships that are arriving in the area, and it's worrisome. No?
Yeah. I mean, I was talking with a former senior FBI counterterrorism guy who's saying, like, you know, it might have been a good thing that that we killed these guys, because we don't know what evidence we could have charged them with if we had apprehended them. Right now, normally you want to apprehend them. But first of all, if they're drugs, you seize the drugs, you prevent it from getting into the country. But you also get access to the people who are supposedly trafficking the drugs. You could see if you can turn them and learn some information about where they're coming from.
Yeah.
Or you could, like, throw them in prison. But, you know, we kill them. We don't know what the evidence was. We don't know what was on that boat. We don't know who these people were.
It was a military attack rather than a law enforcement effort. Mm.
And by the way, the same week that a federal judge ruled that the administration claims about the Venezuelan gang being a part of an invasion by the Venezuelan government did not hold up.
Correct.
And there was insufficient evidence, and she ruled that, and the judge ruled that it was unconstitutional. So, another potential constitutional clash.
So many things wrong with that. It seems to be the motto is shoot first, ask questions later. I wonder how that will translate into Latin for a new, symbol for DOD. Anyway, it's really off the rails, as with so many things in this administration.
Let our Latin scholars send in proposed mottos for DOD on this.
Yeah, they are. They're changing it back. They want to change it back to the Department of War.
Right. Right. Perpetual war.
So those are just a few things on our mind. Believe me, there was a lot more on my mind, but we don't have hours and hours to go on and on. So we're going to move right along now to our interview with Scott Anderson, author of King of Kings, The Iranian Revolution, A Story of Hubris, Delusion, and Catastrophic Miscalculation. Scott Anderson, welcome to Spy Talk. It's just great to have you here. You know, even before this book, you were a widely admired reporter and writer in the arena of international affairs, national security, and so on. And I note that our friend Mark Bowden, in his review in the New York Times, called your book an exceptional and important book. And that raises the question of why this book, this subject, appealed to you. These events took place some 45 years ago. Why is it exceptional and important now?
Well, thanks so much for having me on. I think I've been covering war for the past 35 years, and if you cover war in the modern age, you spend a lot of time in the Middle East. And what I've seen in every war I've covered, and even in countries that are not at war, the effect of the Iranian Revolution has been profound throughout the entire region, and not just the region. I mean, it really certainly it's had a profound effect on the United States. We lost our most important ally between Western Europe and Japan, and I think that it's also the Iranian Revolution was the kind of harbinger for this explosion of religious nationalism that you're now seeing in every major faith around the world.
Mm-hmm. For sure. You know, the thing about the book that's so great, it's got great heroes and great villains. I suppose you could use could count the Shah himself as part of the right. villains. But, you know, he's described, as you well described, he's sort of this passive figure. People tell him what to do. He's afraid to make a decision on his own. But he's goaded on, you might say, by senior U.S. officials who, in their ignorance and greed, I think it could be said, keep propping him up and blindly thought of the Shah as a rock of stability in the right. Middle East against all evidence right. that he wasn't. And I think we can trace that to officials who weren't getting out and actually talking to the Iranians and finding out. And so the hero, if I may say so, the hero of your book is Michael Matrinko, a rather low-level State Department officer who actually took the time to learn first.
Right, one of the few.
And talk to Iranians. And this seems to be a problem since then of, you know, the U.S. officials not knowing local cultures and language and so on. But tell us about Matrinko. He's a wonderful character.
He really is a wonderful character and has become sort of a friend over the course of this. Mike Matrinko went to Iran in 1970 as a Peace Corps volunteer, learned the language. He's a very gregarious guy, so he developed a very wide circle of Iranian friends. He was there until 73. He comes back as a Foreign Service officer in 1977. It's right when things are starting to blow up in Iran, but it's still on this undercurrent. He's attached to the visa office in Tehran at the American Embassy. And what he's seeing is he's seeing wealthy people trying to get out of the country. And he's talking to them in their own language. And people tell him this place is about to explode. But when he tries to report that to his superiors in the embassy, not only do they ignore him, but they actually reprimand him. And to get he's now identified as a troublemaker. So they ship him off to be the consular officer in a provincial city, Tabriz. And it just so happens that Tabriz is kind of the ground zero, the starting point of the Iranian Revolution. And Michael Matrinko is the only foreign diplomat there when it all starts to kick off.
So just to pick up on that, Scott, Matrinko is seeing what's going on, talking to people, and you open your book with this delicious quote from the CIA, and I just want to read it. This is from a secret CIA report, Iran in the 1980s, dated August 1977. The Shah will be an active participant in Iranian life well into the 1980s. There will be no radical change in Iranian political behavior in the near future.
Whoops.
How did we get it so wrong?
It took a concerted effort by an awful lot of people, and it really have to go back to at least to Richard Nixon, if not sooner. The Shah hated having foreign diplomats, even talking to his mainstream Democrat opposition in country, his mild opposition people. So the Americans just didn't. They followed the Shah's direction and never did any domestic intelligence. The CIA had a huge station in Tehran, one of the biggest in the entire region. They got all their domestic intelligence from the Shah's secret police. They did no domestic intelligence at all of their own. So that report that you cited, Michael, is just pulled out of thin air, and it's because what the Shah's secret police and what the Shah wanted the Americans to hear. So there was there's this kind of willful delusion that was going on all sides.
Right. Well, this willful delusion extended all the way to the very top. We have a clip of another scene you describe, fascinating scene you describe. New Year's Eve, 77 to 78, President Jimmy Carter is in Tehran celebrating the new year with the Shah,
the King of Kings.
And here is what he has to say.
In 1978, President Carter toasted the Shah's leadership at a New Year's celebration in Iran.
Iran, because of the great leadership of the Shah, is an island of stability in one of the more troubled areas of the world. This is a great tribute to you, Your Majesty, and to your leadership, and to the respect and the admiration and love which your people give to you.
An island of stability, and the Shah has the respect and love right. of his people.
And 7 days later, the revolution started. Literally 7 days after that New Year's toast. Actually, to me, it underscores an important detail about the Iranian Revolution that I think a lot of people have kind of overlooked. They focus on this religious revivalism by Ayatollah Khomeini, but I think that what really gave the revolution its virulence was that there was these aspects of an anti-colonial uprising, why did all of a sudden the revolution be triggered shortly after Carter's visit? The Iranian people, whether they liked him or disliked him, they all saw Shah as a stooge of the Americans. He was the American Shah. And that goes all the way back to the 1953 when the CIA put the Shah back on power against this kind of populist prime minister. So along with the religious, there was always this aspect of that the superpowers are dictating to us how our country should run. And I think that was really key in kicking things off.
Yeah, and in a way, it's sort of, you know, more powerful there than in other countries throughout the region. And so, I mean, that's a really important part of your book, is to narrate the evolution of anti-Americanism in Iran and how it just, decade after decade, it gets stronger and stronger. But something that really, I know this book is about Iran, and we just heard the clip from Carter, but there's an awful lot in there about the missteps of Americans, whether it's the State Department, whether it's the agency. And my question to you is, even though you narrate it beautifully, my question to you is, do you think that there were lessons learned from this intense optimism and wishful thinking on part of the Americans that you also call a kind of ineptness? And it's not just about not speaking Farsi. It's about refusing to see what could come at the other end until very late.
Yeah. Well, I certainly think there are lessons that should have been learned. I don't know if they're really taken on board. My father was with USAID. I grew up in East Asia, so from a very early age, I was exposed to kind of the American diplomatic community abroad. And one thing I have to say, and it's quite different from European delegations. Wherever the Americans go, especially if they go in force, like in a place like Tehran or for Taiwan, for that matter, it becomes very insulated. You have a commissary, you have a PX, you have an American club. And most of the people, of course, all the locals who work in the embassy, they all speak English. So it's really possible to, and I make this point in the book about people, that you could have done a 3-year tour in Tehran, and the only people you spoke to were people in the embassy who spoke English. The only regular Iranian you would have meet was your gardener. I mean, that was possible. And that was not true with the European delegations, certainly not true with the Russians or the Soviets.
But it's also how the information is received in Washington, which is another very strong point of your book, is that, you know, with whether it's the National Security Advisor or a Secretary of State, even the Vice President, there's a sense of not having a critical sort of approach to this, what this could mean, what this information is, asking more problems. And you point out that part of this is because the Camp David talks are going on at critical moments. But it's not just that. It's just, so do you think that in that way, this lack of, first of all, there's a lot of stovepiping that went on. Have we fixed any of this in terms of breadth, depth, accuracy?
I think that, and maybe the American government isn't unique in this. I think it's very difficult in any organization for bad news or pessimistic news to work its way up the chain of command if the people at the top don't want to hear it. I don't think that has improved at all at the CIA or at the State Department.
We certainly didn't learn the lesson.
No,
in Afghanistan,
absolutely not.
Right? I mean, perfect neighboring country.
So I don't think it's changed. What is remarkable about the Iranian Revolution is that the level of communications at that time had much more in common with the communications of 200 years prior than it does now.
Yeah.
Khomeini's sermons had never been translated into English. The tape cassettes that he was sending in that people were listening to, the CIA was actually collecting them, but they didn't know about spoke Farsi, so they didn't bother to listen to it or transcribe them. And I make the point in the book that today, someone with a laptop and a good search engine could know more about Ayatollah Khomeini in 2 hours than all the intelligence agencies of the West could, 50 years ago, could have learned in a month, because they just had nothing to look for.
But I do think that there's no substitute for learning or knowing the language. I must say, in my brief, brilliant career as a case officer, military intelligence in Vietnam, I discovered a significant counterintelligence problem because I could read Vietnamese. I read the Vietnamese papers every day. And I discovered one of my key agent was a member of an opposition party, an underground party. You know, he's in the protest group. So I do think it's important. I wrote a story on September 12, 2001, quoting a CIA officer saying there not a single station chief in the Middle East and North Africa spoke the local language.
That's right.
On 9/11. So I do think that, you know, immersing yourself in the culture really helps you understand things. I want to dredge up one of the many great quotes in your book is, again, going back to our hero, Matrinko, who's a consular officer. He's issuing visas and to Iranians who want to get out of the country. And the CIA guy is there saying, you know, expedite these visas for our assets. And Matrinko says to the CIA guy, excuse me, Mr. Intelligence Officer, but what does it tell you when your most important sources are trying to get the hell out of the country? Yeah. You know, you think a light bulb would have gone off somewhere.
No, I know.
But no.
You know, I think another thing that Americans abroad are very guilty of, whether it's DOD or CIA or State Department, they don't get out of the goddamn capital. They stay there. You know, if you go back to the fall of the Soviet Union, the consular officers who are out in the provinces, they were predicting that they were saying this place is coming apart at the seams. The guys in Moscow who are like hanging out at cocktail parties or doing what? You know, they never saw it coming.
Last to learn.
And it happens again and again and again. So
it's time for a quick break. We'll be back in a moment with Scott Anderson. And we're back. I wonder if we could just take a step back with a little historical background on your two principal characters, the Shah and the Ayatollah. And let's start with the Shah. Title of your book is King of Kings. He's heir to the Peacock Throne, a 2,500-year-old dynasty, which dates back to presumably Cyrus the Great. But first of all, on the legitimacy question, he has no bloodline that goes back to Cyrus the Great. His father toppled the government that was in the early 20th century. What was tell us a little bit about the claim that the Shah had to be the Shah and how accepted it was among the Iranian people.
Well, not only did he try to claim the royal lineage, but he also professed to be a direct relative of Mohammed the Prophet, which was ridiculous, and all Iranians knew it was a joke. His father came in. He was a Persian Cossack officer, overthrew the previous dynasty, semi literate. Came into power. The last name Pahlavi is just a made up name from their home province. So there's always a question of his legitimacy, I think, in the eyes of the Iranian people. But I think even more, it goes to that idea that he was propped up by the Americans and that he was seen as a vassal of the Americans. And I think that over time, that proved really deleterious for him. The Shah was certainly the most contradictory persons I've ever written about. Even heard about. I mean, he was brilliant, horribly insecure, vain, soft,
indecisive,
incredibly indecisive. And I think the best description I heard, it was a biographer said, you know, he was a hare. He was a rabbit pretending to be a lion. And I think, you know, and when push came to shove, the people realized he was a rabbit. So.
Right. And the Ayatollah, a little about his background, his exile from the country in 1963. So he's out of Iran for, you know, all the time that the revolution is building. Tell us a little bit about his background. Yeah. And what his claim to be a leader of Iran was.
Yeah, Khomeini had been, he was a madrasa teacher in the holiest city of Qom for about 40 years. But he was arch conservative and was sent into exile for really saying things out loud in public against the Shah that no one else would have dared to. So he was thrown into exile. And I really think that a huge part of Khomeini's power came, ironically, from the fact that he was in exile. The Shah operated a massive patronage system. So even, you know, Ayatollahs inside Iran, mainstream opposition politicians in Iran, they were all on the dole. They were all on the payroll of the Shah. If far more than killing people, he would buy them off. So the fact that the Khomeini was in exile and could say whatever he wanted to say, he was seen by a lot of people as this kind of pure, uncorrupted figure when the whole ruling hierarchy of inside Iran was so corrupt. Everybody was on the take, including, again, you know, some of the clerical rivals of Khomeini. So he developed this image of this kind of incorruptible Gandhi figure. People referred to him as this Gandhi figure. And that when the opposition of the Shah really crossed everything from, you know, highly educated, Western-leaning people all the way to, you know, communists all the way to arch conservatives, Khomeini kind of was seen as the common denominator. Like, we could rally around him. Surely he's not lusting after power on his own because he's in his late 70s. But for right now, let's all of us rally around him. And then once we get rid of the Shah, we can sort out who's really in power. Little did they know.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, just one more beat on this. We've talked a lot about how they got the U.S. got everything wrong about the Shah. They also got a lot wrong about, yes, Khomeini. And once it was clear that he was the leader of the revolution, there was a real desire to believe that he was a moderate, that he would be accommodating. They were listening to one of the characters in your book, the doctor from, right, Baylor, Yazdi, <Right. laughs> an American who's assuring U.S. officials, don't, yeah, worry.
Oh, and Yazdi was very clever. What he figured out was that what the Carter administration was most worried about was the communist takeover. We were still in the Cold War mindset of the zero-sum game, that our loss is automatically the Soviets' gain. So once Yazdi was able to convince Khomeini, look, all you have to do is say, you know, we're not going to let the communists into the government. You'd say a bunch of kind of anti-leftist things, the Americans will be reassured. And in fact, Carter famously, and the Shah is still in power at this point, he's sitting around in the Oval Office with his advisors. He says, you know, if Khomeini takes over, it's not going to be the worst thing that happens for us, you know, the worst thing being a communist takeover, which was never, ever going to happen.
Yeah, that's one of the things that's really important about your portrayal of the Americans and how they see things. And you keep saying over and over again, this fixation on the Cold War, this fixation on anti-communism just made them blind to so much was going on. I wanted to bring up your portrayal, if I can use that word, of Brzezinski within this conversation, because we now have Ed Luce's book on Brzezinski, right, which is, you know, and this is really a little different take on Brzezinski, actually. And I'm curious if you could just play it out a little bit more, because you really do talk about him within the context of his being a hawk, his being, you know, and waving the anti-communist flag, and just talk about where you think you've put him in terms of how he's being portrayed by others and has been portrayed by others in the past.
Yeah. I mean, clearly I think Brzezinski did tend to see most things through the lens of the Cold War and of communist takeover. I actually think that he was probably more right than wrong when it came to Iran, that when he said the first thing that Shah has to do, this is in the midst of the revolution, he first needs to restore order. And then he can go back to making the political and economic reforms he was doing before, where Cyrus Vance, the Secretary of State, was saying, no, they need to be done in conjunction. And I frankly think that if the Shah had done a firmer hand early on, he might have saved his throat.
Scott, I'm a little surprised to hear you say that, because in reading your account, Brzezinski, till the very end, is pushing for a military coup. Even when it's clear, even after the Shah leaves, he's focused on is don't give in. Let's get the military involved and take over the government. Was that the right course of action?
No, I think a military coup. No, I mean that was a pipe dream. That was never going to happen in the late stages. I'm kind of referring to like early on, because what I think Brzezinski figured out was that whenever the Shah would try to make reforms or appeasement, the Iranian people saw that as a sign of weakness. Again and again, he promised elections, free elections the previous summer. That did not calm things down. It made things worse. Again and again, releasing political prisoners made things worse. So I think that Brzezinski was maybe right in that you first need to restore order, and then you can go back to this reform thing. The Shah needed to look like he had a spine. And that's what he never did to the Iranian people. But to the period you're talking about, no. At that point in the late stages, where Brzezinski is urging a military coup, he's trying to do this very complicated thing. He's saying, okay, the generals need to stand by the caretaker government. Now Shah's leaving the Bakhtiar government, and if that looks like it's falling, then the military needs to stage a coup. And you know, these are Michael Matrinko, my hero, he knew a lot of these generals, and said, you know, these guys had spent their entire careers sucking up to the Shah. They had never made an original decision on their own. And said, you know, these guys staging a coup, they couldn't maneuver themselves through a grocery store checkout line, you know? And I think he's absolutely right. I mean, the idea of a coup in that late stage was absurd.
I'm glad we're talking about the military, because one thing that is a bright sparkle in the book is U.S. weapons sales to Iran and how they played a role. And you have a wonderful anecdote in there about a U.S. Navy guy saying, I don't care what your policy is, but our policy is to keep selling weapons. Can you talk about that a little bit?
So when the Shah quadrupled oil prices in 1974, it triggered a worldwide recession. But it led to this bonanza of money flowing into Iran. And this came 2 years after Nixon and Kissinger told the Shah, you can buy any weapon system you want without any questions asked, short of nuclear weapons. He gave a carte blanche that maybe the British had. No other country in the world had the carte blanche that the Shah had. And the Shah was obsessed with building a worldwide, a world strength army. So all this money was poured into that. So half of all American arms sales were to Iran by 1975. Generals and admirals were flying in to sell weapon systems to the Shah. And he was like a kid in a candy store. It also helped. So he was buying two generations later of F-16 fighter planes when two generations earlier still being mothballed on airfields because no one knew how to fly them, and just billions and billions of dollars wasted in this way. And it helped trigger the recession in Iran in 1976.
So another fascinating character in your book is William Sullivan, the U.S. ambassador, who for the first half of the book is standing by the Shah 100%. He shuts down your hero, Matrinko, doesn't send his cables as a high priority to Washington, doesn't want to hear anything negative about the Shah. But then when he realizes he was colossally wrong, he completely flip-flops and is trying to get rid of the Shah. And I love it towards the end when Brzezinski is still pushing for a military coup. You know, Sullivan says, tell Brzezinski to go fuck himself.
This is literally on the day that everything's falling apart. It's amazing. You know, and
So how did tell us about Sullivan and why he was so wrong?
He inherited this culture at the embassy. He came in, he had been in for about a little over a year. And this culture that everything was just fine. The Shah was going to be here until his old age, and then his son, the crown prince, was going to take over. And it was the whole culture. It was not even the culture at the embassy, but the culture, of course, the State Department that he was reporting to. Nobody was supposed to see any problems. So when Sullivan did this flip, it's kind of ingenious. How was he able to literally overnight switch on the Shah and say, oh, he's done?
An experienced bureaucrat. That's exactly it.
And he was covering his own ass. It was like, oh, I'm not changing my mind. I'm not changing my analysis. It's the Shah. He's gone crazy, essentially, you know. And going back to this thing of, again, it's the way bureaucracy works. This wonderfully ironic moment, or horribly ironic moment, where Carter realizes he's being really badly served by the CIA, by the State Department, by the DOD, in information coming out from Iran. And he sends a handwritten note to CIA Director Brzezinski and Secretary of State saying, you guys are doing a shitty job. He didn't use the word shitty. You're doing a very bad job of keeping me informed of what's happening in Iran. I need you to start, you know, cooperating and get me up-to-date information. And the effect that little memo had, the handwritten note, was all three men that it went to. And all of a sudden, we're going to get blamed. Who's going to get blamed for losing Iran? So instead of cooperating, it actually had the exact opposite effect. Stansfield Turner, the CIA director, then put the word out throughout the CIA that they were to have no contact with the National Security Council or the State Department, that any information about Iran was to go through him personally. So everybody like went into their silo. So in effect, Carter's memo just made things exponentially worse. And that's, you know, there's something about just the nature of bureaucracy in that I think.
Speaking of shifts, one of the things you talk about, going back to Mike's earlier question, is Khomeini, when he's in exile and trying to think about what narrative he's going to try to sell. And one of the things he talks about is a democracy based on Islamic principles. And then he comes in and, of course, moves in a completely other direction. But I'm wondering, what do we know about what he meant?
Well, I think in Khomeini's case, it was just rhetoric. And I'm not even sure it was his rhetoric as much as it was the three kind of Western educated advisors he had right around him, who were serving as his mouthpiece when he was in Paris for the Western media. I think they had a dream of kind of a, you know, Islamic based democracy. But Khomeini, going way back to the 1960s, he was talking about the only legitimate government in the world is one appointed by God. So in the absence of God on earth, you have a supreme leader who is the inheritor of God, representative of God, and that is him. So, but the amazing thing is that paper he wrote back in the 1960s, it had never been translated into English, but also had never been seen in Iran, because Khomeini's teachings were banned in Iran. So one of the three men, the Western men who were around Khomeini and promoting his cause, when he actually saw this writing of Khomeini's from 20 years earlier, he said, oh, no, this is a forgery. This is from the Shah's secret police. Nobody could possibly believe this. You know, they're just trying to tarnish Khomeini's reputation. So, you know, he kind of fooled them all. And he knew when he knew when to play the moderate role. And, you know, and then once the Iranian Revolution happened and there's this period of chaos before the hostages are taken and Suzman take over, a lot of Khomeini's clerical rivals have a bad habit of dying of heart attacks. There's like two or three of them. I think he was just, you know, more clever and more cunning than anyone gave him credit for.
Scott, I have to ask you, you know, you're not the first person to write about the Shah and the fall of the Shah, and the role of the CIA in Iran and so forth. I reviewed a book 20 plus years ago about this. Is there something that came up that surprised you in your research that you didn't expect to find or really or motivated you to write the book? You came across something that was all new and people didn't know and needed to know about?
The one thing that surprised me was the degree to which the Carter administration still viewed everything from the vantage point of the Cold War, and what kind of rhino vision they had of what would happen in Iran if the Shah went. The other thing that just struck me again and again was this: you know, most revolutions there's a steady escalation in them. There's an intensifying of the violence or the repression, and so it eventually succeeds, or the state machine gets enough people that it collapses. But with the Iranian Revolution, there was this bizarre ebb and flow over a year where it seemed like things were calming down, and then 2 weeks later, it looked like the Shah was about to go. And one thing that a lot of people who were revolutionaries that I've talked to have said, you know, even 2-3 weeks before the revolution succeeded, we never thought it was going to succeed. We thought we were going to have some compromised parliamentary government. The Shah would be more of a figurehead leader, but we never thought the revolution was going to play out as it did. So there was this very, very odd element of happenstance and coincidence throughout the revolution that really kind of surprised me.
I don't think the Bolsheviks thought they were going to win either.
That's right, true. Yeah.
Good point. So your book climaxes with this extraordinary human drama of the Shah is ill. He's dying of cancer, and he needs high-level treatment. At the time, he's traveling around the world, first Egypt and Morocco, then
Mexico, right.
Jamaica, Bahamas. Yeah, yeah, right. But some pretty heavy hitters are really pressing the White House and Carter to let him into the United States. But it's pretty clear that if we do that, there's going to be consequences Iran. Walk us through that drama, the ultimate decision Carter makes to let the Shah in, and of course, what that leads to.
One thing that most people don't know or forgot is that right during the revolution in February of 1979, when the Iranian revolution succeeded, the American embassy was attacked by gunmen, and all the embassy staff were taken hostage. They were released after about 8 hours. But that was the background event that played out over the next 8-9 months with the Carter administration. So periodically, the Shah was always trying to come to the United States. The State Department would ask the ambassador in Tehran, you know, is it okay to let him into the country now? And they said no. And famously, I think it was William Sullivan, the ambassador, said, if you let the Shah in the United States, we're going to come out of here in boxes, meaning in coffins. So they kept rebuffing the Shah. Then all of a sudden, in October, early October of 1979, the Shah is deathly ill. And again, something else the Americans had no clue of, that the Shah had actually been suffering from leukemia for the previous 5 years and being secretly treated by a team of French doctors. So all of a sudden, the Shah is deathly ill. Doctors rush down to see him in Panama, say he has to come to an American hospital for treatment or he's going to die. Turns out that wasn't true. But so famously, on October 23rd, Carter has a meeting in the Oval Office. He brings in all his closest foreign policy advisors. And he goes around the room and says, should we let the Shah into the country? And everybody around the room, Brzezinski's there, Vance is there, Brown, they all say, yes, we have to let him in. It's a matter of national honor. And Carter says, what are you guys going to tell me to do when they overrun our embassy and take our people hostage? And there's just complete silence in the room. And Carter says, yeah, I thought that's what you were going to say. So they let him into the country. 10 days later, the hostages are taken. So Carter was wrong about almost everything about Iraq, but on that one thing, he was actually quite prescient.
We have to start wrapping this up, Scott. Let me ask you this, and it may be an unfair question, but to what degree do you think these events of a half century ago still motivate Iranian policy and the Iranian population today?
That's a great question. And I think you see it right now with what's happening in Iran. I still stay in touch with people inside Iran in a kind of a discreet way, most of whom would consider themselves in the opposition. And since the American and Israeli bombing of in July, they're all despondent. They feel this is so, there's been a huge rallying around the flag effect with the regime. Now, if you go out and protest the regime inside Iran, you're seen as a stooge of the Israelis and the Americans. So that's the kiss of death. So it still resonates very, very strongly. So you're at this weird juncture, I think, right now with the Iranians. On a regional power level, they've been greatly weakened. Their proxy allies throughout the region have been kind of smashed one after the other. But I think internally, they're probably stronger than ever. And they can continue to play the American and Israel card. And they've been very deft in doing that for years. So I don't think the regime is very popular among, I mean, I hear figures of 15 to 20% of people actually support it. I don't know where those numbers come from. But I think that the memory of the Iranian revolution, the memory of the Shah, to the degree it still exists, is still a great flashcard you can play to whip up public sentiment.
So the protests and so on we've seen are really, the bombing has kind of eradicated the ability of protesters.
That's right.
Everyone's rallying around the flag now, either through fear or coercion. Right.
When you say they continue to play the U.S. and Israeli card, what that means as a practical level is they send assassins to the United States, to Europe, around the world to kill Israelis, to kill American officials. They're backing the Houthis with their firing of missiles towards Israel. What is the right policy that we should be taking towards Iran, given this kind of behavior?
Yeah, I mean, my feeling is that engagement always works better than quarantining regimes like this. It's not a perfect comparison, but I think of Fidel Castro in Cuba. The greatest thing that ever happened to Castro was the American embargo. Because secret police never go hungry, armies never go hungry. So if you put sanctions on a country, all you're really doing is strengthening the rule of the strongman. I think every American I know who's visited Iran in recent years, and people find out they're American, Iranians love them. There is not this deep-seated hatred of Americans on a personal level. So I just feel that the more you bring, to the degree it's possible, you bring Iran into the community of nations, I think that's going to further weaken the regime. I think that quarantining mm-hmm. it does not achieve that.
Sure, I think anyone who visits China, Vietnam, places we have continuing struggle with or past wars with, you find that ordinary people like Americans. They like talking to us. With that, Scott, we have to unfortunately wrap it up. This has been absolutely fascinating conversation. Congratulations on writing a terrific book that the whole world loves. I mean, the reviews are through the sky.
Let's remind people of the title, King of Kings, The Iranian Revolution, A Story of Hubris, Delusion, and Catastrophic Miscalculation.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Our great pleasure.
Thanks, Scott. That was great.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. And so that's it for now. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isagoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
We'll see you next time.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
It's no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.